Krishna Krishna Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai. When the directors of the Mahatma Gandhi Memorial National Fund invited suggestions on how to commemorate Gandhi's life and work, Abhay wrote to them and simultaneously to Vallabhai Patel, India's deputy prime minister, proposing the Gandhian way to use the funds. Gandhi's whole life was dedicated to the service of humanity at large, with special interest for raising the moral standard. His later activities showed that he was equal to everyone, and all the people of the world knew him more as a spiritual leader than a mere politician. Devotion to Godhead was his ultimate aim, and when I say that his sacred memory should be perpetuated not in the ordinary way, but in the Gandhian way, I mean that fitting respects to his memory will be done in the following manner. Abhay wrote of a Mahatma Gandhi rarely described, Gandhi as a Vaishnava. Despite his pressing political activities, Gandhi had never missed his daily prayer meetings in the evenings. Even at the time of his assassination, he had been on his way to attend his daily kirtan. Abhay stressed that it was because of Gandhi's regular participation in congregational prayer that he had been strong in his work to raise the moral standard of humanity. Quote, Gandhiji, minus his spiritual activities, Abhay wrote, is an ordinary politician, but actually he was a saint amongst the statesmen. Abhay wrote that it had been Lord Chaitanya who had originated the congregational chanting of the names of Krishna and Rama, and his six followers, the six Goswamis, had left a wreath of wealth of literature for discussing and understanding. The memorial board should take this lesson from Mahatmaji's practical life and develop it on a large scale. Therefore, one fitting memorial to Mahatma Gandhi would be to institute daily congregational readings from the Bhagavad Gita. When people's spiritual instincts were kindled by daily prayer meetings, then they would develop the highest qualities in their character. Abhay had a second suggestion. Gandhiji was known for his attempts to enable the lower classes to enter the temples, and in Noakhali, he had installed the deity of Radha Krishna for the ordinary man to worship. Although this was generally taken as a side issue of Gandhi's work, Abhay took it as the essence. That Gandhi's was a theistic movement. Abhay explained that although there were hundreds and thousands of temples in India, they were not being properly managed, and therefore educated citizens were neglecting them. In the original Vedic literatures, the purpose of the temples had been to nurture spiritual culture. If the temples of India could be reorganized as vital spiritual centers, then the disturbed minds of the day could be trained for life's higher duties. Such education and practice, Abhay wrote, can help man in realizing the existence of God, without whose sanction, according to Mahatma Gandhi, not a blade of grass moves. And so we see as Prabhupada, one is he's taking, you know, any opportunity there is to preach. Yes.
What does assassination mean?
Assassination means where someone, specifically tries to kill them. You know, so generally assassination will be, you know, some political leader or somebody like that, a prominent figure. And so then when they're killed, then, you know, like assassinate kings or things like that, you know. So in other words, when there's politics involved, you know, on big later level, then that's generally assassination. Okay. So Prabhupada's here is taking any opportunity to try to find some way to preach, right? So it's like, and if they take it, nice, but if not, then at least, you know, he did his part, right? He saw an opportunity, he took it, and then if it follows through, nice. If it doesn't follow through, then he'll keep looking for other opportunities, right? So it's not that if one time it doesn't work, you stop, you have to keep going. And we see here is that he was taking elements of whatever Gandhi was saying and starting from there and then taking it forward, not saying that, you know, well, I say, you know, Gandhi was, you know, studying Gita and all that, but he didn't necessarily have a sampradayic understanding, so therefore it's bogus. He would, you know, which is maybe true, but he would be taking it from the angles that he's studying Gita, and that's very good, so why don't we cultivate that aspect and get everybody to study Gita, right? So naturally, the next step is then you have to have bona fide people to teach it. But, you know, but he's starting from that point, or that everybody coming to the temple, that everybody has that opportunity. So he may have been looking at it just everybody's equal, everyone can come. It may have been more of a welfare humanitarian element. But he was taking the element that, you know, all jivas are equal, so therefore then, you know, everybody should have an opportunity to worship the Lord. Does that make sense? Yeah. So he's taking something that the point itself is within our philosophy. The person's understanding of it may not be in line with our philosophy, but you start there, right? Because then otherwise, what do you have in common with any other living entity who's not God conscious? Right? Basically, not so much. Right? But whatever any living entity is doing is part of, you know, how God has created everything. So they're going to be doing something that it is connectable to God consciousness. Right? Does that make sense? So you start with that, but you get to the essence of it. It's not the outside of it, the form of it. It's the essence of it. Right? You find that, then it works. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like that. You know, it's just like, let's say, boys are playing marbles, right? So in their mind, they're looking at it more from the playing of marbles. But you could look at it from the point of view of, you know, devotees associating together, you know, on a common platform. So their common platform happens to be marbles. You know, that's, you know what I'm saying? But the principle of association is important, so you could start from there, that this association is an important thing, so regularly, you know, the devotees should come together and things like that. But, you know, you might take it a step further, okay, they'll come together, maybe marbles isn't the, you know, ideal thing, you know. Come together in the temple, everyone get out their marbles. No, like not like that. You understand? You take something that's the basic principle of it, and then expand from there, right? In other words, any action is covered by fault, so the fault you leave, what's useful you keep, right? Just like you have a potato. So you just pick up the potato as it is and then, you know, cook with it, right? What do you think? You're not sure. You know what a potato is. Maybe. What we have here, you wouldn't call potatoes, they're not big enough or something. Do you use the whole potato when you cook?
Yes.
Yes?
No.
No. One more is there, very good.
You wash it and then sometimes you peel it.
Okay. So, and then what about a cauliflower? Just as it comes from the market, you just throw it in the pot, right? Okay. So you see so many of these vegetables and all that, there's something that has to be done, right? So most of it is good, some of it's not useful, right? So what's useful, you keep. What's not useful, that's what you get rid of. Right? It's not that the potatoes have peels, so therefore you throw them all out. No, you just peel them. Does that make sense? So what part is useful, that you keep. So whatever somebody's thinking about, talking about, or doing, what's useful, that part you deal with. What's not useful, that's what you throw out. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? You know, like the sadhu sangha is okay. The marbles may not be so important. Does that make sense? Or the sadhu sangha is okay. Yelling, screaming, you know, beating each other and like that. That part you can leave out. Does that make sense? Does it make sense or no? Yes? Okay. He also referred to Gandhi's Harijan movement, which most people saw as Gandhi's humanitarian effort to grant equal rights to untouchables, whom Gandhi had recognized as Harijan, people of God. Abhay stressed that this was also an essential spiritual aspect of Gandhi's life. But rather than simply rubber stamping an untouchable as Harijan, Abhay argued, there must be a systematic program for elevating people of the lower classes. Right, so he didn't have a problem with that they could be elevated, but it's not just because you say they're Harijans, right? Hari is, you know, means Vishnu, and Jana means people. So they're saying the Lord's people. So just because you say they're that doesn't mean that they act like it. But some will say that they're like that even if you try to educate and elevate them, they can't be. Right? But we know according to Shastra they can be, because every living entity is part and parcel of Krishna. Right? So he's taking the part that's useful, the part of elevating everybody, giving everybody a chance, but at the same time he's saying, but still they must be educated. Right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah? This program was taught in the Bhagavad Gita and could be best applied under the guidance of a bona fide devotee of the Lord. Abhay volunteered to take up the work on behalf of the memorial board. If the board, in attempting to commemorate Gandhi's efforts and accomplishments, neglected the essential spiritual aspects of Gandhi's life, Abhay warned, his memory will soon be dead, as has been the lot of other politicians. Right? So he's saying all these, starting from these points, showing us here, so therefore we should do it in a proper, appropriate way. Right? And then Prabhupada's saying, so therefore, you know, bona fide persons could do, so he can start, and then he will teach, then that way then so many more people will be trained, then they can teach more, and then like this it will expand. Perhaps they saw Abhay as another opportunist seeking money or as a sectarian religionist. But Abhay saw himself as a lowly servant of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Seeing certain Vaishnav qualities in the character of Mahatma Gandhi, Abhay took the opportunity to introduce his spiritual master's message to the world. And by so doing, he paid tribute to Mahatma Gandhi, praising him as a great devotee, interested in kirtan, temple worship, and elevating unfortunates to become people of God. Right? So he's just taking that part and then working with that. Right? But others don't. It means there's one God. He's created everything. Everything works according to his rules. Right? So that's basically pretty universal, no? So now if you follow those rules, teach those rules, you know, then that's universal. Right? But people not understanding that it's God who's running everything, then they'll think it's just a particular religion or a particular group or something like that. Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty with the mundane perspective. While on business in Madurai in South India, Abhay showed some of his writings to Muthuswami Chetty, another medical salesman. Mr. Chetty was impressed and felt he could persuade his wealthy friend, Dr. Alagappa, the famous Birla of the South, to finance the printing. In April of 1984, Mr. Chetty wrote to Abhay saying that he had been prompted to help Abhay for something God has meant. He asked Abhicharan to send him the complete Gita Upanishad manuscript so that he could present it to Dr. Alagappa in Madras. Mr. Chetty had already written Mr. Alagappa about the first-class work, Gita Upanishad, to cover 1,200 pages of royal size, and had urged him to publish it for the benefit of religious-minded people. He had also mentioned that Abhay had been trying to publish the book since 1946. Mr. Alagappa soon replied to Mr. Chetty that he was interested, and Mr. Chetty wrote to Abhay, quote, "So I'm on my way to help you, and only God must help me. As for talking business with Mr. Alagappa, there will be no need since, quote, once he does it, it is for the sake of benevolence." Anticipating success, Mr. Chetty invited Abhay to come to Madras and meet Dr. Alagappa. Quote, "There he will arrange for what God has meant for you to do in your religious duty." In Madras, Abhay would be able to check and correct the proofs of the manuscript and see the book through the various stages of printing. It was a big opportunity, and Abhay was not one to miss an opportunity. If the book could be published, it would be a great victory in his mission to fulfill the request of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. But then the worst thing happened. The manuscript was stolen. It was the only copy, the one Abhay was keeping safely at home. He questioned his family and servants. No one knew what had happened. Abhay was baffled. So much work had been undone. He felt that he had worked so many months for nothing. Although he couldn't prove anything, he suspected that his servant or even his son might have done it with a motive for raising money. But it remained a mystery. During 1949, Abhay wrote articles in Bengali and submitted them to his godbrother, B.P. Kesha Maharaj, who published them in his Gaudiya Patrika. Abhay's format for addressing world problems... Abhay's format for addressing world problems was the same as the spiritual masters. Even at their first meeting in 1922, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had countered Abhay's nationalistic arguments by stressing that the real crisis in the world was neither social nor political nor anything material, but was simply the dearth of transcendental knowledge. So when we discuss the various aspects, then this is the principle, is that it's spiritual knowledge that is the problem, where we're lacking spiritual knowledge and that. So it may manifest as political or social or economic problems, but that's not actually the problem. The problem is God consciousness, right? If you're God conscious, these other things can be corrected, right? So that's the principle. So sometimes we may talk about, you know, Varnashram and the need and this and that, but we're talking about it as a social system or culture that devotees would follow, right? For helping in devotional service. Does that make sense? You know, some way to elevate people, another aspect. Yes? Abhay simply elaborated on this theme. He never advocated that the ordinary concerns of the world would be disregarded, but he stressed that crisis can be solved only when the leadership is God-conscious. Right? So it's not that you ignore problems, right? Whatever's going on in the world, but those problems have to be brought in line with God-consciousness. That's the main thing. If God conscious were put first, other concerns could be brought into line. But without God consciousness, so-called solutions were only folly. Right? Yeah. So that's always very important, is that if you have God consciousness, then you can make everything else okay. But if you try to make everything else okay without God consciousness, it'll never work. You get some temporary solution, possibly, and then it will disappear again. Abhay began his first Bengali article by quoting an editorial from the Allahabad edition of the Calcutta newspaper, Amrita Bazaar. The editor had sorely lamented that India's worst troubles had not yet ended. despite national independence. Quote, "The National Week has begun. The memories of Jallianwala Bagh and political serfdom no longer trouble us, but our trouble is far from being at an end. In the dispensation of providence, mankind cannot have any rest. If one kind of trouble goes, another quickly follows. India, politically free, is faced with difficulties no less serious than those that trouble us under a foreign rule." Right, so he's saying is that all that's happened is you get rid of one problem, another one problems come. You know, that's Prabhupada's point, is that if it's no God-conscious solution, then just another problem will come up. Right? So here then, they got rid of the foreign rule and all the problems that went with it, but now they have new problems that are just as bad as the problems they had under the with the British. Right? So that's the material world. Right? Abai seized on this editorial reflection as proof of the basic defect of all worldly plans for amelioration. He pointed out that although India had been subjugated by foreign rulers since the time of Muhammad Ghori, that's AD 1050. So that means it's like almost 1,000 years. India prior to that had never been subjugated. In those days, India had been a God-conscious nation. It was when India's leaders had abandoned their spiritual heritage that India had fallen. Thus, Indians should see that they were now being punished by the stringent laws of material nature. Quote, "The honorable editor of Amrita Bazar Patrika," Abai noted, "has written so sadly, if one trouble goes, another quickly follows. But that was stated in the Bhagavad Gita a long time previously. It was the same thing that he had stated in his 1944 Back to Godhead articles, and the same thing of so many of his letters also. Man, due to his neglect of the Supreme Lord, is being punished by material nature, which is directly controlled by the Supreme. Men may write newspaper articles, pass measures at meetings and conferences, and attempt to overcome nature by scientific research. Yet they will remain unable to surmount nature's law. As they try to escape their punishments, the Supreme Lord will cast them deeper into illusion, and they will fail miserably." Abai quoted an appropriate Bengali saying, quote, "I was trying to make a statue of Shiva, but I ended up making a monkey." He means you're trying to make something nice, but you end up with something not so important. That's not saying that you monkeys are bad. We're just saying you're not exactly Shiva. That's all. That's, that makes sense. Shiva means auspicious. You know. What do you think?
I think it's good.
It's good. Okay. And you? What do you think? Good. You? You?
Good.
Yeah, good. Okay. Okay. So then I think this is Prabhupada's writing. "In order to rid the world of misery and bring about happiness, we have now created the atomic bomb. Seeing the all-pervading destruction which could take place in the near future by atomic reactions, Western thinkers have become greatly disturbed. Some people try to give consolation, saying that we will only use this atomic energy to bring about happiness in the world. This is another enigma of the illusory potency," right? They create the atomic bomb, it blows up, you know, can cause so much destruction. And then, because everyone becomes so much in anxiety, then they say, no, we'll only use it to make people happy. Right? But that's not so clearly defined, because, you know, another country's bothering you, so if you drop the bomb on them, then you become happy, right? So then it's not saying which people you're trying to make happy. You know, so, yes? "The problem," Abai explained, "is that the world was lacking Krishna-conscious devotees. Leaders under the influence of material nature could never solve the problems of the world. Materialistic illusion was especially prevalent in the Western countries. which Indians should not try to imitate. Abai prophesied, however, that Krishna consciousness would one day reach the West. Right, so it's like, in other words, there's illusion everywhere. So there's illusion, you know, he was probably saying, it's not that illusion is not there in India because they're being distracted by so many things. But he's saying it's more prevalent in the West because they're not even connecting anything to Krishna, anything to God, you know, technically. They're religious, they have faith in God, they worship God, but they don't actually connect what's going on in the world with God. Right? So that element's there. But in India, they do. Bhagavad Gita will tell how all that happens in that. So there's much more of a chance of people being God conscious, you know, in their day-to-day life. Well, and the other is just they'll be, you know, try to be religious, try to be nice. Yes? No? Maybe? Something. Yes? What something? A little more Kashundi on the Moody, or... No? You don't like Kashundi and Muni? You don't like?
Masala Muni, maybe, but not
plain Muni. Masala Muni, but not plain Muni. Do you prefer mustard oil in your plain Muni?
Yeah. Milk.
Just milk. Oh, okay. And you?
Milk.
You?
Gur.
Huh?
Gur.
Gur Muni. Oh, okay. Any other options? You?
Milk.
You?
Milk.
Milk. Okay, it seems to be there. You?
Fruit salad.
Huh?
Fruit salad.
Fruit salad. With the moody. Yeah? Okay, there's another option here, okay? Keeping that in mind, it's different. What are the more popular... Okay, saying that Krishna consciousness would go to the West. In the Western countries, there's never been any discussion of the relationship between the atomic individual soul and the supreme complete conscious personality of Godhead. Neither their activities nor their state in ultimate perfection has been investigated. That is why, even though they have made so much material advancement, they are squirming in the burning poison of sensualism. We can be absolutely certain that India's real peace formula will one day reach their ears. Right. So he's saying that in the West they never actually discuss the nature between the atomic soul, you know, the spirit soul, and the Supreme Lord who is fully conscious and is a person, right? So that's never discussed like that. They don't know the state of the living entity. They don't know the process for making that connection. None of these things are discussed. They'll discuss so many things, but these points never actually come up. Abai's articles began appearing regularly in the Gaudiya Patrika. His godbrothers appreciating his writings. His denunciation of the materialistic mentality was reminiscent of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's. In Abai's hands, the Bhagavad Gita's concept of the Asura was no longer merely a depiction of a mythological or legendary enemy. The Asuras had come to life in the modern-day Hitler, Churchill, or even an Indian prime minister. But as Abai pointed out, his denunciation of the leaders was not his own. He was only repeating the words of Krishna. Right? In other words, demon means one who goes against the Vedic principles, against devotional service, the philosophy, all these things like that. That's the thing. During 1950-51, he continued his letter writing, attempted to gain a hearing with various organizations and leaders. He wrote the World Pacifist Committee, the President of India, and the Minister of Education. He wrote to the Indian Congress for Cultural Freedom, which wrote back suggesting that Abai had written them by mistake. He wrote to an official of the All Religious Conference in Bombay, advising that because of their approach, nothing practical would come out of their conference. The practical solution is lying in the transcendental message of Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, as given him in the Bhagavad Gita. In September 14, 1951, he corresponded with Danielle Bailey of the American Reporter, a magazine published by the American Embassy in New Delhi. Abai pointed out that the philosophy of understanding the absolute truth, as realized by the sages of India, was higher than attempts to combine East and West. Mr. Bailey replied that he was aware of Eastern philosophy, philosophical and religious influence in the West, and cited the progress of a yoga mission in New York City, which he said had some influence on the Protestants in America. But when Abai asked if one of his articles could appear in the American Reporter, Mr. Bailey replied, "If we were to give considerable space in the American Reporter to, say, the Gita, we in all fairness would have to give equal space to the other philosophies, and our desire is not to endorse or condemn any of them, but simply to assist in a better understanding." In a further reply, Abai differed with Mr. Bailey's contention that people should be encouraged to make their own interpretation of religion. Quote, "Less intelligent men are always guided by those who are superior in knowledge in all spheres of life." Abai even wrote to the Ford Foundation in Detroit, and a staff assistant wrote back, "Regret to advise you that we are unable to pursue your suggestions concerning the establishment of an association of the intelligent class of people. The Ford Foundation has no program in which specific ideas such as you describe might be included." Although most of his suggestions were rejected, occasionally he received words of appreciation. A certain Dr. Muhammad Saeed, PhD, a professor at the University of Allahabad, wrote, quote, "You seem to have assimilated the universal teachings of ancient India, which is really laudable." And the governor of Uttar Pradesh replied, "You are doing noble work, for nothing is nobler than to be God-minded." Not only was Abai giving advice in his letters, but he was hinting that he could also give practical help. If he could obtain institutional backing, he was prepared to do many things: teach classes, manage temples, teach temple worship, and initiate devotees, as well as organize various kinds of field work to propagate the principles of Bhagavad Gita. Usually he did not spell out exactly how things should be done, but he pointed to the philosophical defects in the present methods and the superiority of working in accordance with the Vedic literature. By the grace of his spiritual master, he knew the science of applying Bhagavad Gita to almost any situation. If someone would only show interest, he could teach that person the superiority of working according to Bhagavad Gita. After attending a meeting in which a prominent industrialist had stressed harmonious relationships between labor and management in his factory, Abai wrote a long letter suggesting the man consider the good effects the congregational chanting of Hare Krishna could produce. Since the factory had a special employees club and lounge, Abai suggested that the workers assemble there and chant Hare Krishna. Abai urged everyone to surrender to Krishna, but most people had their own philosophies and took his spirit to be sectarian or proselytizing. You know, in other words, he was preaching and trying to get others to follow what he was doing. But Bhagavad Gita was universal, Abai wrote, and God could not be omitted from any program, even in the name of a secular state. Krishna, as the father of all living beings, had jurisdiction over all programs, organizations, and governments. Indians especially should appreciate the universal scope of Bhagavad Gita. Although Abai had always had a plan of action behind his suggestions, he first sought the interest of his correspondent. There wasn't much interest, and he was repeatedly turned down. But he never felt discouraged. He always anticipated finding a sympathizer. He kept copies of all his letters and their replies. A word of appreciation or a slight show of interest from a correspondent being sufficient to elicit from Abai another thoughtful reply. Right, so he tries sending things out to everybody. And then if anybody replied, you know, favorably or showed interest, then he would continue that, you know, however much he could develop it. He had developed a keen sense of dedication to Lord Chaitanya's mission, without expecting leadership from the Gaudiya Mutt. He still cherished the idea that his God brothers would soon come together and preach, but he didn't put any energy in the Mutts, since to do so would mean to become involved in one of the factions, right? In other words, to go to the temple means he had to be part of this or that, so he didn't want to become part of that, so he just avoided it. Staying clear of the Gaudiya Mutt's internal fray, Abai continued his letter-writing campaign alone, introducing himself as a preacher of Bhagavad Gita and editor of the Back to Godhead magazine. In 1948, Abai closed his Lucknow factory. He had fallen behind in employee salaries, and since 1946, had been paying past rent in installments. But when sales dropped off, continuing the factory became impossible. He lost everything. Srila Prabhupada, I started a big laboratory in Lucknow. Those were golden days. My business flourished like anything. Everyone in the chemical business knew, but then gradually everything dwindled. With the help of some acquaintances in Allahabad, he opened a small factory there. In the same city where his Prayag pharmacy had failed 15 years before. He moved to Allahabad with his son, Brindavan, and continued manufacturing medicines, while the rest of the family remained at Banerjee Lane in Calcutta. Abai continued his traveling, but now he was often away for months at a time. And then he had the dream a second time. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati appeared before him. Again he was beckoning, indicating that Abai should take sannyas. And again Abai had to put the dream aside. He was a householder with many responsibilities. To take sannyas would mean to give up everything. He had to earn money. He now had 5 children. Why is Guru Maharaj asking me to take sannyas, he thought. It was not possible now. The Allahabad business was unsuccessful. Quote, at present, the condition of our business is not very good, he wrote his servant Garanga, who had asked to rejoin him. When the condition gets better, and if you are free at that time, I will call for you. He worked earnestly, but results were meager. Right? So now, Garanga, that servant before, he was trying to come help him in the business, had decided to go home. Right? And so now he was trying to contact again and come and be part of the business scene. But he said, now the business isn't doing so good, so then later if business is better, then we'll call. So one should be very careful about one's opportunities. Right? Like we see, Prabhupada always took an opportunity. As with everything else, Abai saw his present circumstances through the eyes of Scripture. And he could not help but think of the verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, Yasyaham anugrinami harishye tadhanam shanaihi tato dhanam tajantyasya swajana dukha dukitam. When I feel especially merciful towards someone, I gradually take away all his material possessions. His friends and relatives then reject his poverty-stricken, this poverty-stricken and most wretched fellow. He had heard Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati quote the verse, and now he thought of it often. He took it that his present circumstances were controlled by Lord Krishna, who was forcing him into a helpless position, freeing him for preaching Krishna consciousness. Srila Prabhupada, somehow or another, my intention for preaching the message of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu increased, and the other side decreased. I was not disinclined, but Krishna forced me. Quote, you must give it up. The history is known, how it decreased. Right? So as Prabhupada is saying that his interest in God consciousness was increasing. But and he wanted to preach and everything. But it wasn't that he was specifically disinterested in, you know, just the different activities that he had, the different duties, you know, his business, the family, and this. But you said by Krishna, he was forcing, right? Krishna was controlling the situation and making everything slowly, slowly get more and more, less, right? Yes? What's wrong with the toe? Bumped into some rock or some bridge, some... Yes? No? It's your toe. I don't know. I'll ask him. What's wrong with his toe? You don't know. What's wrong with his toe?
I don't know.
What's wrong with his toe? So nobody knows. So that means only you can say what's wrong with your toe.
I bumped it on a rock.
You banged it on a rock. And so you were carefully walking through the garden, and this big nasty rock jumped out, and you banged into it, right? No.
I accidentally kicked it.
You accidentally kicked this big nasty rock who just jumped out of nowhere. No. You were running through the garden like a complete madman, not paying any attention to anything, and you kicked a rock. Maybe. Okay. Something like that. I guess all the rest of the pieces everybody can fit together, I think. In Srimad Bhagavatam, Queen Kunti had also prayed, quote, "My dear Lord Krishna, your lordship can easily be approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling." Srila Prabhupada. "So in 1950, I retired, practically. Not retired, but a little in touch with business. Whatever is going on, then almost it became nil. Whatever was there, all right, you do whatever you like." Right, so that was 1950. He was writing in 50-51 all his letters and all that. But basically in 50 then he stopped. When did he have the dream again? Yeah, 48. So in 50, basically, he retired. Whatever was there, it was going on. If it went nice, if it didn't go, he wasn't going to worry about it. Abai's wife independently moved, along with the sons, back to her father's house at 72 Mahatma Gandhi Road. She had reasoned that her financial support was becoming precarious. Abai was spending most of his time away from home. He was gradually disassociating himself from the family. When after several months he would meet his wife and children, his father-in-law would criticize him. "You are always going outside. You are always worshiping God. You are not looking after my family." Whenever he could, Abai would send his family some money. Mr. Sudhir Kumar Dutta, Abai's nephew. "I sometimes noticed how he was thinking so many things about his family, about his writings, about making bigger and bigger in business. What to do, what to do. He was thinking seriously to earn some money from his business, but that means he has to give more time for his business. And his writings he never gave up. He was writing more and more, and people sometimes abused him. 'Hey, you are writing religious things. You are only thinking of God. Then who will maintain your family? What will you do for the family?' Sometimes he argued with them. 'What has this family given me? Why should I forget about God? This is the real thing. What I am doing, you cannot realize what I am doing.'" Right? So the Prabhupada, some of the different, you know, family members, other things would say, you know, "You're only thinking about God. You're not doing anything. You're not making, you know, big money for the family and this and that." And he said, "Well, what have they done for me, right? They're not God conscious. They're not trying to be God conscious. His sons won't help him in the business, right? Otherwise, why is the sons grow up? Why don't they run the business, right? So he's doing, but alone he can't do. He needs help, right? The servant won't help, sons won't help, and then they complain, you know, where's the money? So then what are you supposed to do, right? What do you think? Maybe you're not sure. On a visit to Calcutta, Abai stayed at the home of his father-in-law, where he was given his own room. When his wife served him dinner, he noticed that everything had been purchased from the market. "How is this?" he asked. "The cook is sick today," Radharani replied. Abai thought, "It is better that we not live here at the home of her father, or else she will be spoiled even more." So he moved his family to a new address on Chetla Street. Here he sometimes stayed with his family for a few months, writing articles and doing a minimal amount of business. But most of the time he stayed in Allahabad. Right. Yeah, so the Radharani went back to her father's house. And then instead of cooking, then like that, they had a hired cook like that. Because generally speaking, your aristocratic families, even though no matter how rich they are, they wouldn't keep cooks. Right, because you do your own cooking. Cooks clean, they can cut sabji, wash pots, stuff like that. But they never will cook. Right? Cooking is always done by, you know, the members of the household. So that they were, having a hired cook that's already not actually very proper. And then when the cook doesn't come, instead of cooking themselves, they just buy something from the market. You know? Does that make sense? So therefore Prabhupada thought, you know, this is not going so well. So he decided to move back to, get his own house and move back to there. In Allahabad, Abai, now 54, lived like a vanaprastha, or one who was retired from family life. He was indifferent to the activities of family and business. Activities a family man generally considers his prime objects of responsibility and happiness. In his writings, Abai has several times discussed the four ashrams, or spiritual divisions of Vedic society, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. In the first division, the brahmachari ashram, a young boy's parents send him to the place of the guru, or gurukula, where he lives a simple life, studying the Vedic literatures under the guidance of his guru. Thus, in his childhood and youth, he learns the principles of austerity and spiritual knowledge that form the basis of his entire life. Strange. It didn't mention running around like a madman and bumping into rocks. Is there something wrong here in this?
Minor detail.
I mean, it was just overlooked by the editors. I mean, Gurukul doesn't mean running around chasing each other. No?
Crashing on bricks,
okay. Another option is variety, right? Rocks, bricks. Then you have the big, big rocks, right? You know. No. Okay, so that's the base. At age 21, the brahmachari may take a wife and thus enter the next ashram, the grihastha ashram. Or, like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he may choose to remain a lifelong brahmachari. In his boyhood, Abai had remained celibate and had imbibed the principles of devotion to Krishna from his father and mother. Although he had lived at home, his upbringing had been the equivalent of brahmachari life. And by marriage, at the age of 21, he had entered the grihastha ashram at the appropriate age. Gormohan's example has shown Abai how to remain a devotee of Krishna, even in family life. And as Vaishnavas, Abai and his wife had avoided the excesses of materialistic household life. At 50, a man is supposed to retire from his family activities, and this stage is called vanaprastha. In the vanaprastha ashram, both man and wife agree to abstain from further sexual contact. They may continue living together, but the emphasis is on spiritual partnership. As vanaprasthas, they may travel together on pilgrimage to the holy places in India, preparing for their inevitable departure from the material world. Thus, the Vedic ashramas, after allowing one to fulfill material life, enable one to end the cycle of repeated birth and death and attain the eternal spiritual world. A man of 50 should be able to see by his aging body that inevitable death is approaching, and he should have the good senses to prepare.
Right, so it's said that when the hair, you know, you start seeing gray hairs and you see the children of your children, then it's time to go to the forest, right? Because otherwise, you know, you're getting old, right? So, grandpa, take note, right? You know, so it's time for vanaprastha. So that means then you, means basically then the relationship between husband and wife is focused on spiritual activities. Their sadhana, their studies like this. It's not so on business and family so much. You know, maybe they're a little bit, but it's mainly this, the emphasis shifts like that. So a spiritual, you know, companionship, that partnership, that's what's important. Is that guy asleep over there? One in the middle? No. Okay, so that means from 50, because that means that you're married like that, 21, 25, then by 50, then the children are grown up, they're responsible, they can run their own life, you know, they would be married by that time, you know, they would have children, so then one can move on, right? Let the next generation, you know, get out there and try to make the material world a better place, right? So no. Okay. Yes? No? Maybe? Not sure. Thinking of other rocks to bump into or something.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi ki.